This episode of the World Soccer Talk podcast is presented by Sling. Watch the CONCACAF Gold Cup in June and July with Sling TV. With the best teams competing against the US to win the competition, watch the games on Sling TV. Hello and welcome to the World Soccer Talk podcast. My name is Christopher Harris. I'm joined by my co-host, Kartik Krishnayar. This, Kartik, it's hard to believe, but this is episode 1,500 since we began the podcast in 2006. It's, what are we, 2023? It's been like, what, like 17 years? 1,500 podcast episodes. I would have, in the beginning, I would have never imagined it would have gone this long and this well. What about you?
Yeah, I never would have imagined it either, and it's just such a great testimony to everybody at World Soccer Talk that's worked with us through the years, and the different incarnations we've had of this podcast. We've really kind of pivoted and adapted to what the audience wants and what our readers are interested in. So we started out as an interview show. I mean, we brought some of that back with what Kyle does midweek, except on video this time. We've gone through incarnations of doing review shows of European football and English football, doing stuff in terms of major tournaments, World Cups, Euros, Copa Americas, doing daily shows about that. Went into broadcast pretty heavy for several years and broadcast media and analyzing that. And now talking about hot topics in the game.
All right. Well, a big hot topic is in the last 12 months, Saudi Arabia has been working on trying to change sports as we know it, whether it's golf or tennis, and now soccer. The wealthy Arab nation has set its sights on conquering world sport. This week there was a quote, I think it was in the mainstream press, but it was from the president of the Saudi Arabian Football Federation. And he said in regards to kind of all of the investment in the sport, he says, sport is a key driver of Saudi Arabia's ongoing transformation under Vision 2030, which has established the kingdom as one of the fastest growing and most exciting countries in world sport. We believe hosting international events provides an opportunity to grow the game further and to inspire new and existing fans while showcasing to the world Saudi's hospitable culture and huge passion for soccer. So in soccer circles, Saudi Arabia's public investment fund, PIF, now owns an 80% stake in Newcastle United and owns 75% of the four most popular Saudi Pro League teams. And as we've seen in the transfer window in the last 12 months, I mean, it's every time we look at it, there's another transfer rumor or signing. The Saudis have signed so many stars, including Cristiano Ronaldo, Karim Benzema. Last week was Ruben Neves, N'Golo Kante. And many, many more players linked to the Middle East nation. So, Kartik, I ask you, what's the big deal? Why should we pay attention to this story on this podcast, this topic? And also, do you have any concerns about what Saudi Arabia is doing?
Yeah, so initially, early last week, there was a lot of interest in the British press about the number of player sales from Chelsea. Potential player sales. The only one that's actually crossed the line as of this recording is Hakim. Is not Hakim Ziyech. That hasn't been closed yet. Is N'Golo Kante, and that was done earlier on. So, but the number of potential player sales from Chelsea to Saudi Arabia, and the suspicion about Clear Lake Capital and Todd Boehly's other business ventures in Saudi Arabia. Now, it does appear like there is a remarkable amount of interest from the new big four that you referenced in Saudi Arabia. Those four clubs, which are all in Jeddah and Riyadh, the two largest cities in Saudi Arabia, those four clubs in Chelsea players. But we also know Chelsea have 35 first-team players or whatever, and they need to dump a bunch of them. So logically, if you're the Saudis and you're trying to build this this league with Vision 2030, build those four clubs at the PIF, and I should point this out at the top, Saudi Arabia now has the prospect of having a very unbalanced league, like so many of the leagues in Europe, where the PIF has invested in four clubs, and the other 16 clubs in the first division don't have that investment, and all these big players we're talking about are going to those four clubs. So, but if you're looking to build those four clubs up, I guess the first place you'd look is Chelsea, because they have a bloated squad and they need to dump players. But multiple articles in the Telegraph and then follow-up from other outlets in Britain indicated that there seemed to be some smoke in terms of the relationship between Todd Boehly and the Saudis, and also that the Saudis are helping out Chelsea in terms of potential FFP problems, because as we know, Chelsea has spent more money in the last 12 months than any club, more money on transfers than any club in the history of football. So they need help. So that's something I am concerned about. Now, the other side of this is the number of guys that are going to Saudi Arabia that probably are entering their last contract or their next to last contract, their last big contract, and European clubs can't afford to retain them or competitively bid on their services. And we've seen phases like this before with the NASL, with Japan, with Qatar, with the UAE, with China most recently, right? The Chinese Super League. And those things tend to fade. They tend to go through these kind of phases. I don't know that this is a phase. I think this might last longer, but it also doesn't concern me because as much as that potential Chelsea story, because I don't think there's a license, a right, I don't think it's necessarily healthy that that all those players stay in Europe permanently. And then I also think that there is a sustainability question around a lot of European clubs, clubs like Inter, who plainly have to dump players, and China is an outlet for that. One thing I do want to mention, though, one caveat is Ruben Neves has moved from Wolves to Saudi Arabia. He's Wolves' best player. They're a club that fought relegation all season. He's only 26. That concerns me. Like a guy at that age, a guy at that level, a guy that is that critical to the club he plays for, moving to Saudi Arabia. That's a little different than Benzema and Conte and whoever else going, right? I mean, that's that I think is more of a red flag. But worth noting, Wolves also in FFP trouble. And this probably saves them for a season of FFP sanctions making the sale. So Saudi Arabia is there as an option for players and for agents if they need to get their guy out of a situation where the club he's at is in FFP trouble and no one else in Europe can really afford his wages.
So, Kontek, let's break this down. I mean, like, so that representative, or actually the president of the Saudi Football Federation, was saying that one of the reasons they're doing this is to showcase to the world Saudi's hospitable culture and passion for soccer. But really, what is the reason? Why is there this sudden interest in Saudi Arabia now in investing in soccer, actually in sport, right? Basically kind of taking over, shaking up the golf world. It may do the same or pretty similar to it in soccer. And we've seen recent investment from Qatar. Practically any soccer game you watch these days now, whether it's the CONCACAF Gold Cup, whether it's the World Cup, Premier League, most of the advertising you see is Qatar. I mean, whatever the slogan is, embrace Qatar or visit Qatar, whatever it may be. But what at the heart of this, what is the real reason that Saudi Arabia suddenly is hugely interested in soccer?
I think it is a sport washing element. And I think it's not just we talk about sport washing in terms of the Saudis and the Qataris and the Emiratis, UAE, trying to gain acceptance in the West. That's really the perspective we talk about. There's another perspective, which is the Saudi regime is a brutal regime, but football is a very popular sport in Saudi Arabia. Unlike China, where it's not particularly popular per capita, U.S., it's not particularly popular per capita. What other countries did I mention earlier? Japan, they were trying to grow the game when they went out and got a lot of the top players that they got in the 90s. Saudi Arabia, it's kind of a bread and circus thing. I think they feel like if they give the masses – these top football stars, there might be less reluctance to rebel. There may be more reluctance to rebel. They might keep even some of the migrant workers. For example, there are 2.5 million people who are registered as Indian citizens or of Indian origin in Saudi Arabia. And when you consider how small the kingdom's population is, 30 million or so, that's a pretty big chunk of the population. So keeping people like that happy as well. You're bringing them Ronaldo. You're bringing them Benzema. You're bringing them Conte. You're potentially bringing them now Roberto Firmino and Hakim Ziyech and any number of other guys. I've heard Brozovic, a player I rate really highly, linked with Saudi clubs. So so many guys that maybe satisfy the palate of football fans in Saudi Arabia. Again, different than China. China's qualified for one World Cup. We know Saudi Arabia qualifies regularly for major international tournaments, and they beat Argentina in this last World Cup, right? They gave a very good accounting of themselves at this last World Cup.
So we saw with Qatar in the World Cup in regards to sports washing, right, in terms of all of the human rights abuses, everything that's happening within Qatar, lack of human rights there, and how Qatar continues to try to paint a different picture, tries to focus on, look at all these great things we're doing for sport, essentially in some ways buying out the sport in some ways in terms of coverage. We saw that with Fox's coverage of the World Cup. So much of it was sponsored by Qatar, the main sponsor. Some of the editorial decisions that Fox Sports made certainly would have been favorable to Qatar, as we saw on television. And then we've got Saudi Arabia. We won't go into all of the human rights abuses there, Kartik, but there is Jamal Khashoggi, the reporter, the journalist, who was killed at the Saudi consulate. I think it was in Istanbul, dismembered, probably because of his criticisms of the Saudi Crown Prince. And there's plenty of other human rights abuses too. A lot of shady stuff that happened in Saudi Arabia. And in Saudi Arabia, the leader, MBS there, has been given U.S. immunity over the Khashoggi killing. They never did find his body. So Kartik, from a human rights perspective, I mean, is this something we should be worried about in terms of what Saudi Arabia is doing with the sport of soccer and growing it and trying to use it for sports washing? Is this something we should be should pay attention to and try to stand up against this?
Yeah, we absolutely should be concerned about it. And we've obviously seen that there's already a backlash when Newcastle was bought and reporters rightly and diligently pointed out the Khashoggi killing and any number of other barbaric practices in the kingdom. And actually, Kingdom of Saudi Arabia is that much worse than Qatar or UAE. So people complain about the Qatar World Cup or Manchester City's ownership or PSG's ownership. I mean, the Saudis are much, much worse. And really like a medieval kingdom in reality in the way that they govern so many things. So you absolutely should be concerned about that. And here's something to watch also, Chris. Like we talked about with Todd Boehly, there seems to be a situation where as private equity and investment bankers and these sorts of entities get more involved in buying football clubs in Europe, largely U.S.-based investment bankers and U.S.-based firms, hedge funds, hedge fund managers also are involved in this. Right. They all have ties to Saudi Arabia, which is why I ultimately don't know the truth about the Boehly situation. I don't necessarily want to jump to the conclusion a lot of people in the UK have, which have said now this is the most corrupt thing ever. You know, it's funny. They were three weeks ago, they were complaining about Manchester City and FFP and UAE. And now that's child's play compared to what they are inferring might have happened with Chelsea and Boehly's connections to the Saudis. I don't want to jump to that conclusion. If it is, in fact, what people suspect it is a huge, huge scandal and a huge blight on football. But I don't know that it's it's just not a coincidence, right? Because so many of these investment bankers and hedge fund managers and people involved in private equity do business with the Saudi royal family and with the PIF, with the Saudi Sovereign Wealth Fund, which owns Newcastle and owns the majority in these four clubs we've talked about in the Saudi league, that it's kind of, you could make that guilt by association in many cases. Ultimately, we don't know the truth, but here's the thing. As we keep going in this, as the Saudis continue to become bigger and bigger players in football, I think we're going to be asking these questions when Chelsea sells players to the Saudi league or whoever the next team is that has some sort of investment bank owning them or some sort of hedge fund, right? And like Alan Pace, the owner of Burnley, comes from that sort of world. The next time one of those clubs sells a player to Saudi Arabia, we're going to be suspicious. And again, I want to make this clear because Chelsea fans jumped down my throat a week ago on social media and on Beyond the 90. I am not sure yet. There is smoke. I don't know if there's a fire. And I know the Telegraph seems to have jumped into thinking that there's a definitive link. I don't want to go there yet, but it does look suspicious that there are five or six Chelsea players going to Saudi Arabia when Chelsea are in FFP trouble. We know the Saudis are upping their spending on football, and we know the ties between them and Bowley. So there is plenty of reason to be suspicious.
All right, let's move on to listener mailbag. And Karthik, we've got a lot of feedback from listeners in regards to the last podcast we did about US Open Cup and MLS's involvement or lack of involvement in that. First up is Dan. Dan says, the comments made by Major League Soccer and the Players Union are disingenuous at best. How can they possibly complain about venues for Open Cup games while they're going to be running the Messi show from the Drive Pink Stadium? They lose all credibility in that discussion. As much as anything, I feel that they're struggling to justify the idea that MLS is far superior to USL. They're not. USL and USL Championship and MLS are closer in quality than the impression that's often given, and the Open Cup exposes that. MLS would be better off taking the cup seriously and trying to crush the USL Championship. I don't believe that they really could just decide to do that. The tournament against Liga MX will be great for the League's Cup, but what happens if Liga MX runs MLS off the pitch? John Adams says, I enjoyed your chat about the US Open Cup on the recent podcast episode. One thing that wasn't mentioned about the venue comments is that MLS clubs that are hosting games are also not putting their best foot forward. I'm a fan of San Diego Loyal, and we were drawn to play Seattle Sounders away in this year's Open Cup. I was originally excited to see my local club potentially play in a much bigger venue than we typically do. Except when game day came around, the Seattle Sounders played host at their MLS Next Pro venue. So if MLS wants to criticize the venues in the US Open Cup, they also need to evaluate themselves in this regard too. Stones and glass houses and such. Thank you. Love the podcast. Khalil says, US Open Cup would only be relevant if there was promotion and relegation in the United States so that the lower division teams were ultimately building towards something and the first division teams were trying to avoid relegation. Not that it would or should have a direct influence on that, but what makes, for example, the FA Cup special is that those lower division teams are all trying to rise. Rob says that MLS playing too many games is a joke. Firstly, this is what squads are for. Secondly, every team in the English Premier League plays as many league games as the finalists that play in the MLS, and more games that actually matter. Teams fighting relegation aren't going to roll over for the top teams. The real problem is that resting the best players over a season makes it harder for a team to win MLS and the Open Cup and the CONCACAF Champions League in the same season. Doing the treble should be extra challenging and not the expectation of the best funded team in the league. Premier League teams often use the early rounds of the League's Cup. Premier League teams often use the early rounds of the League Cup, English League Cup. There's too many League's Cups. English League Cup, Carabao Cup, to rest the starters and give the second string and young players some competitive matches. Kartik, let me take a pause there. There's some really good comments and input from the listeners. Any thoughts on any of those points raised?
Yeah, I think that there's, to me, no question that also to Dan's point, that maybe undermining U.S. Open Cup has another purpose that we didn't really discuss on Friday in that podcast, which is since USL Championship clubs do very well in the tournament, maybe this undermines the idea that the results of the tournament matter, because the head-to-head comparison about quality of the two leagues can be made based on results in the tournament. MLS teams win the tournament every year. However, every season there are several being eliminated by lower division competition. Last year we had a USL team reach the finals. This year we had two reach the quarterfinals. So if the 30 best teams in the country are all MLS teams, or I don't even know how many teams are in MLS 29. Anymore. 29, 30, 29. Yeah, if the 29 best teams are in MLS teams, logically, if you have a quarterfinals, now obviously because of the draw, teams can play each other earlier, MLS teams, although they do protect them, by the way, in round three, MLS teams can't face each other. If that were the case, then the 8 quarterfinalists would all be MLS teams.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Right? But in the round of 16, you had two MLS teams lose to USL teams, which is how two USL teams got into the quarterfinals. So they don't want the comparison. That is absolutely correct, and that has always been the case with any competition that potentially embarrasses MLS. I can go back to my own experience with the CONCACAF Champions League. We had a team, Puerto Rico Islanders. They beat the LA Galaxy over two legs in the qualifying phase of that tournament. And the very night that the first leg took place, or maybe it was the second leg. Well, one of the two legs. The very night that took place was a night that Don Garber made comments to the media about minor leagues and characterizing lower divisions as minor leagues. And, you know, it would be great to have relationships with the minor leagues. And then I think made some kind of crack about market sizes and some of the places that there were lower division teams. So there's always an insecurity that that comes out when they're in these competitions and teams from the lower divisions do better than the MLS side.
Next up is Vihan or Vihan, and he says, I do not follow Major League Soccer, but I would love to watch Inter Miami games for Messi. Is the MLS season pass the only option I have, or are games going to be shown live on Fox and other channels? Is this similar to what NBC has with the Premier League? So great question. So over the course of the regular season, there's, I think it's 34 games. 34 games are going to be televised on Fox. We're already more than halfway through the season, so we've already gone through a lot of those on Fox and FS1. So there's going to be, I mean, basically just a little bit more than maybe a dozen games left to be shown on television. So roughly about one a week on television. Now, every single game is streaming on Major League MLS Season Pass. Even if it's on television, it's on MLS Season Pass also. And then the comparison between the Premier League and Major League Soccer. So with the Premier League, roughly 50% of the games are exclusive to Peacock. In Major League Soccer, the amount of games that are exclusive to MLS Season Pass is about 88%. So a big difference, right? It's 88% of the games are exclusively available on MLS Season Pass for the regular season. And then the remainder, 12%, are also available on television on either Fox or FS1. Great question. Next up is Scott. Scott says, MLS has made a critical mistake with Messi. They have failed to address the issues ahead of mass production. They have made the DMC DeLorean mistake. It's no secret MLS has failed to sell the product domestically. Their temporary solution remains simple and effective, expansion. But expansion can't last forever. And now they have placed this version of their product center stage to the world that'll be mocked and ridiculed. These new fans are buying Messi, not Major League Soccer. Take away Messi, and what is MLS selling? Number one, they're selling participation is bought, not earned. Number two, 29 teams are insufficient number for a league. Number three, playoffs should decide the champion, not league form. And then number four, low division clubs are not a vital part of the soccer pyramid. Does this sound like a product that these fans want to watch? Does this sound like a legitimate soccer league? The recent comments made by Zlatan and Gareth Bale should be a huge red flag. They walked away with the verdict, it's not the real thing. These new arriving fans are no different. MLS has now cemented the narrative and has spent billions trying to overcome out of their own arrogance. Billionaire band-aids don't work in the public square of soccer. Just ask Qatar. Some strong words there from Scott. We've seen Qatar too, even in the Gold Cup. I mean, even the World Cup, right? The worst performing team. And then the Gold Cup so far, this week, losing to Haiti in the last minute. So on the pitch, not so much for Qatar. Off the pitch, I could argue that actually they've done well in terms of trying to buy a lot of broadcasters and fans. But Kartik, any take on that in terms of what Scott's saying? Some pretty harsh stuff, but it's valid, right?
Yeah, I think it is very valid. And the recent comments by Bale were particularly, to me, telling, given the timing. And this is something that, by the way, American players have said. Casey Keller on ESPN FC a few years ago said that he was struck when this was right after the U.S. hadn't qualified in 2017 for the 2018 World Cup. So now it's about 5.5 years. So I said recently, kind of recently, semi-recently. Keller said when he got to Seattle, he was shocked, right? Because the team would lose a game or two and it would be no big deal. Oh, we'll just go get him next time. There was no real consequence, he felt, for losing. And that was something very new to him culturally. He had been overseas since he moved to Millwall, I think, in 92. So he came back, 2009 is when he came back to MLS. So he'd been in Europe for 17 years and had played in Germany, England, and Spain. So he had seen, you know, a lot in all those different countries and cultures. And it was a red flag for him. And he was pinning part of the U.S.'s failure to qualify for the 2018 World Cup on that. So these are the types of things that MLS fans like to push back on, but they're real issues. And for someone like me, who's very invested in lower division soccer, who's been around lower division soccer, who's talking to people in lower division soccer almost every single day, we do feel like we're excluded. We feel like, in many ways, we're not part of the greater soccer ecosystem, even though we're producing more of the players and more of the grassroots energy and the participatory side of the sport for young American men and women, because MLS and NWSL, throw them in there, have these single entity things that are based on expansion and basically buying participation. So it really is backwards.
I could see, though, with this, Kartik, so when Messi comes, the stadiums are going to be sold out. Television coverage for those games, those few games that are on Fox, I could see those breaking some records. I could see 2 million people tuning in or perhaps even greater than that. I could see big numbers for a game, maybe his debut, whatever it may be. MLS season pass, even though we won't see those numbers, I'm sure those will skyrocket. But ultimately, it may end up being that MLS is not the one that actually profits from all of this. Well, they will profit, but in terms of long term, it might be that you're introducing a whole new audience to Messi. They see Messi play. They're wowed by his incredible skill, seeing it first person or seeing it on television, introducing new people to the equation. And ultimately, the long term benefit from that may be just generating more soccer fans. And as those soccer fans become more educated or more well-versed in terms of what are the best tournaments or the best leagues, what are the most competitive ones to watch, some of that will be MLS. But I would argue that it could be Serie A, it could be Bundesliga, it could be Liga MX, it could be the Premier League, it could be the Champions League, it could be so on and so forth, that it's going to, they may end up being the actual long-term winners in this, and it may not be MLS, because at some point, people are going to start watching MLS more closely and see some of these other games and see some of these other teams when Messi's not involved in them. And with 29 teams, right, it is a diluted league in terms of the talent. Some teams are great. For the most part, some are not so great. I mean, it's very inconsistent. I think so far this season is going on right now, is on track to beat the records of the most 0-0, 0-0 games in MLS history. So there's been a lot of duds. I mean, and unfortunately, a lot of them have ended up being on television. Those big games, the FS1 or the Fox games, there's been a lot of those. So it will ask a lot of the questions about long-term, once the buzz evaporates with Messi, you know, and things get back to normal. I think the quality is going to be something that people are going to look at and go, I mean, we're missing something. Is this the best of the best? No, it isn't. So which are the best leagues or tournaments? And those audiences may go in that direction. But by that point, though, too, MLS would have cashed the checks and would be at least sitting pretty in terms of generating a lot of traffic and money. So maybe they won't care at that point because they're thinking maybe more short term. All right. We have a voicemail from Chris. All right. Here's the voicemail.
Hi, guys. I have a quick question for you guys about NBC's Premier League coverage for this upcoming season. My question is, with NBC selling a good amount of Big Ten college football and basketball games this upcoming season, especially in the fall and winter, could this mean significantly less Premier League games on linear TV, NBC, and USA? And if so, what would be the Premier League's reaction to that?
All right, Kartik, as the expert college sports fan, it's not me. what do you think about this? Do you think Chris has a point here?
I guess. I mean, to be honest, you say I'm a college sports fan. I really only watch the ACC and in basketball, so I don't know when the Big Ten football games are. I think they're probably, I'm guessing they're noon and 3:30 Eastern, although noon would be 11 Central time, right? So that
right.
And Big East is most Big Ten is mostly Central time. I don't know if it would cause a conflict. Now in basketball, it will. CBS did show some Big Ten basketball games this year in February, and the Big Ten tournament in March, in time slots which would be the same time NBC were showing the 12:30 Eastern time kickoff in the Premier League. So basketball, definitely there could be conflicts. Football, I assume there could be also. But remember, with Notre Dame, NBC was able to bump, was often able to bump those games to where they're starting at 3 or 3:30. The coverage is starting at 3 and 3:30, and they get the Premier League match in as a lead-in. The Big Ten contract, I believe, is being split three ways, right? It's CBS, Fox, and NBC. So maybe they'll work around their other commitments. I think it ultimately depends on golf, because golf is split. The PGA Tour, and maybe there'll be a format change next year with this LIV merger. Who knows? But it's split between NBC and CBS. And where we see other events end up has a lot to do with whether CBS or NBC is showing golf that particular weekend. And that includes the Premier League. We've seen Premier League games dumped since the beginning of the time with NBC 10 seasons ago because of golf.
Yeah, about Chris's question about like what the Premier League's reaction to that would be. If it does happen, I don't think they have an issue with it. I mean, it's those games are available on Peacock if they're not available on NBC or USA. I mean, they have other TV networks they could put games on if that was an issue. CNBC is one example on weekends. But we've seen from the Premier League in terms of Peacock, I mean, some of those games are getting over 500,000 to 750,000 people just watching games on Peacock, which is fantastic numbers. So I don't think it's an obstacle or a deterrent for most people. Adam says, what are your thoughts, Kartik and Chris, on the 3 p.m. blackouts in the United Kingdom where there's no football shown for 2 hours until 5 p.m.? Are you for or against the, this has been since the 1970s, right? But are you for or against the blackout window in the UK?
I'm for it because it protects local football clubs and lower league clubs from being overwhelmed by people staying at home watching, potentially watching Premier League games.
Yeah.
So I think it's an important way of force of maintaining support for local clubs. That's why it's in place.
I'm for it, but because of I can rub it into my any British relatives or friends I have, I can like, we've got access to every single game. We can watch all the games from the Premier League during that window, but you cannot. I'm kidding, of course, but I see both points on this one. I mean, in this day and age, it does seem crazy to have blackouts. And I think we've seen the benefits of not having blackouts for Major League Soccer, making it simpler, making it easier for people to watch games. And but it would have an impact on lower league soccer. And yeah, and if it does hurt that, then ultimately at the end of the day, I don't think it should be changed. All right. Last but not least, we have a voicemail from Juan.
Hey, World Soccer Talk podcast crew. My name is Juan in North Carolina, Charlotte. I am a big fan of Serie A and your podcast last week about what CBS could do to improve it. There really needs to be a larger discussion on the Spanish audio. I grew up with Spanish audio, as a native Spanish speaker, Spanish audio of soccer, football was very important to me, and it still is. So I wish CBS would at least have some sort of world feed for Spanish audio. I can't stand any of the English audio that is not Mateo or Dre Cordero. So just props to them. They're really good, but they can't do every game. So we really need a Spanish world feed like they have for English and Italian language. Thanks again. You guys are the best. Bye.
So yeah, Juan, great points there too. The secret to this, and most people don't know it, is that some games are already in Spanish audio for games on Paramount Plus for Serie A. Now, to find it is not easy, and it depends on which device you're using. But we do have an article at worldsoccertalk.com that walks you through the different steps to be able to figure out if there is Spanish language commentary available for those games. At least it was last season. So I'll drop that link in the show notes. So take a look at that and see if that helps answer your question. To the larger question about but why doesn't all the games have it? I don't think there's that much demand. I mean, yes, it's nice to have, but how many Spanish language viewers are interested in watching Serie A? What do you think, Kartik? Is there a bigger audience there than people might think?
No, I don't think it was ever a driver from talking to people back in that era, that period at BN when they had BN Sports in Espanol. It didn't get the numbers they wanted, nor when ESPN showed the matches in Espanol. That having been said, I think CBS has been a little... it's tough to poke holes in CBS's soccer coverage because it's been so comprehensive.
Negligent.
We talked about, but I think they've been they've been a little negligent in alternate language feeds on Paramount Plus for the things they have the rights to in the alternate languages. Now they don't have UEFA Champions League rights or CONCACAF rights in the alternate language, but they do for some of their other properties, and they've been very reluctant, I think, to exploit that.
Yeah, and that's the thing that's been missing overall from CBS Sports since the beginning, since they've had soccer coverage, is that they don't have a Spanish language channel, right? I mean, you look at Fox Sports. Fox has FS1, FS2, etc., but they also have Fox Deportes. ESPN has ESPN channels, and they have ESPN Deportes. BN Sports has the Spanish language channels and the English language channels. NBC has Telemundo, so on and so forth. But CBS does not have a Spanish language channel or division or branch where they could say, okay, let's go ahead and have those games on that. So even when they have the rights, it's difficult, right? What do you do with them? And then if you do audio for some of these games, it's you're losing money on that. You're not going to gain money on that. So it would be something that they would just do now and again, perhaps. But yeah, but great point, Juan. All right, guys, let's finish up there. We appreciate your feedback. Feel free to let us know what feedback you have, questions, etc. We'd love to read those out on air. There's a bunch of different ways you can reach out to us. We've gotten a bunch of voicemails this week, which is fantastic. You can leave a voicemail at 561-247-4625. You can go ahead and send us an email, which is web@worldsoccertalk.com. You can go to the website, worldsoccertalk.com, and click on podcasts, and then leave a comment in the latest podcast episode. What else? Facebook.com/worldsoccertalk, youtube.com/worldsoccertalk, and on Twitter @worldsoccertalk. So a bunch of different places to leave your feedback. And again, we appreciate every one of those. And we'll always do our best to try to read those out on air. We promise to try to get to everything, but sometimes it's difficult. So, all right. And Kartik, where can listeners find your written work and other podcasts, perhaps? Or and also, where can they find you online on social media?
Yeah, so at beyondthe90.substack.com. And looking forward to probably finally taping an interview with the owner of Club de Leon this week, and that's an exciting club here in Florida in Nisa, and other written work there at Beyond the 90. You can find me on Twitter at KKFLA737.
All right, we've got CONCACAF Gold Cup this week, of course, with more games, US against St. Kitts and Nevis, plus much more from around this hemisphere and from around the world. So whatever you do, Kartik, what are you going to do, and what should the listeners do?
Enjoy your football.